Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We have several tournaments to review in this episode. The Asian Games have just concluded. The Africa Division 2 was played, and there's been a number of associate warm-up games to go through. To join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, let's start with the women's tournament, the Asian Games. The format for both the men's and the women's was to have two groups of three, which the top two going through the quarterfinals, where they were joined by four seeded teams. In the women's competition in what was called Group C, there were three teams, South Korea, China, and Hong Kong. We expected China to go through, but we thought it would be close with Hong Kong. We weren't at all sure what would happen with South Korea, but I think it's probably, for once, our prediction came pretty well. In the first match, South Korea and China played, and South Korea were bowled out for 49, and China chased down fairly comfortably without stressing themselves out too much.
A pretty clinical performance from China. Ruan took 5 for 9, with Korea only scoring 49, as you say, and then they took the time a bit to chasing down the target, but they won by 8 wickets. Pretty simple win for China, but obviously South Korea is the first ever women's international, so I don't think we expected anything really from them.
In the next match, China played Hong Kong, which was presumably top of the group, and this was a particularly close game. China's probably fair to say didn't bat particularly well. They only made 83 off their 20 overs and 9 down, but managed to keep Hong Kong just below them with 79 with just 5 wickets down.
I think the entire women's tournament was quite low scoring, and this match was no exception. Hong Kong, I think, owed a lot to Kinu Gill, who scored 45 not out of the 79 Hong Kong runs. Without her, then the Hong Kong Indians might have looked a lot less respectable. Hong Kong would be, I suppose, disappointed they couldn't just kick on a bit and win that game.
And in the final group match in Group C, Hong Kong needed to win to come through in second to match up against Sri Lanka, and they did so fairly comfortably. They scored 92 for 6 off their 20 and bowled South Korea after 57.
A pretty dominant performance against South Korea. Hong Kong had quite a few runouts in their innings. There were actually 5 runouts, which I don't know, must be some sort of record. They sort of started well with a 53-run opening partnership and then sort of seemed to almost throw it away with all those runouts. But South Korea sort of didn't really get close, bowled out for 57. Kinu Gill played quite well in this match. He scored 33 and took a couple of wickets. So again, Hong Kong safely through to the quarterfinals.
And in the other group, which contained Malaysia, Thailand and Nepal, the first match was between Malaysia and Thailand. And Thailand, who we would have expected to dominate this group, won quite easily by 9 wickets, chasing. They bowled, got Malaysia out for 8 for 49 for 20 overs and chased it down in just 11.4 overs.
Yeah, Thailand, probably the best associate side in Asia for women, as far as women's cricket goes. And prove that today. Chantham took 4 for 6 with Malaysia bowling out for 49 and then absolutely no trouble at all scoring, reaching their target, did so in just under 12 overs. So, yeah, pretty dominant performance by Thailand.
In the second game, they're playing Nepal, who have a little bit more history with women's cricket. And again, it was a fairly dominant performance. They kept Nepal to 8 for 64 and then managed to chase it down in 15.2 overs.
Yeah, again, as we said, they're the team to beat in Associate Women's Cricket in Asia, and proved that again today. Natia Buchacham, the captain, scored 24 not out as they won, who was the top scorer of their innings. And yeah, a pretty dominant performance by Thailand in that first round.
And the final group match, which was to come second in the group, between Malaysia and Nepal. And Nepal won this fairly comfortably in the end. They scored 3 for 88 off the 20 overs and managed to bowl Malaysia out for only 42.
Yeah, I think Malaysia will be very disappointed with the performance here. I think they were they were hopeful of getting through to that quarterfinal stage, and in the end, they just weren't good enough. Came up against a very good Nepal side. Karuna Bhandari took 4 for 6 in the Malaysia innings, and they were bowled out in less than 15 overs. Pretty disappointing performance by Malaysia.
So, to the quarterfinals, Japan was the seeded associate. They were joined by the other three full members, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. China played Japan in the first quarterfinal, and I'm not really sure we call it an upset. It was going to be probably always going to be a close game. China ended up winning reasonably comfortably by 7 wickets with 8 balls in run.
I think we probably expected it to be close, but I don't think we'd ever expected China to win by 7 wickets if they were going to win. Japan, perhaps a little bit rusty. They've not played since maybe, I think, April. Very disappointing. Wood Wan took 3 for 11 for China. And, they knocked off the runs just under 19 overs to win by 7 wickets. Not surprising that China won, but perhaps surprising of the margin of victory.
And the other quarterfinal on that side of the draw was a little bit of a poison chalice for Thailand, who had to play Pakistan or end up winning the gold medal, and probably you almost expect to be the strongest side in the competition, even though Thailand won their group. And they did okay, but they still lost fairly comfortably by 51 runs.
Very strange format that Thailand won the group and then got the strongest team in the competition in the quarterfinals. Seems a little bit unfair, such a tournament format. Pakistan, pretty dominant, 97 for 5. The game was reduced to 14 overs. There was sort of rain about throughout the entire tournament, really, which could explain some of the low scores. And then Thailand, they batted out their overs against a full member. So, something to take home from the tournament there.
And on the other side, Hong Kong had to play Sri Lanka, who a little bit of an inconsistent side, I think it's fair to say, but they played particularly well against Hong Kong. They scored 149 for 5 off their 20 overs and then kept Hong Kong to 67.
They bowled Hong Kong out, of course. Only one of the Hong Kong batters got double figures, and that was Keanu Gill again, who had a pretty decent tournament, to be fair to him, but none of the rest of the Hong Kong batters could really do anything. And extras was the joint top scorer with 16, which is something we seem to see a lot in women's cricket, unfortunately. Bowled out for 67. So I think Hong Kong will be disappointed with that performance, but they're coming up against a very, very talented team.
And certainly a repeat of their earlier match as well, that there was a number of run out opportunities. The commentary seemed to imply that they were a little bit risky in even the runs that they were taking, and perhaps lucky to get away with it as often as they did. So definitely something they need to work on there in terms of their selection of runs.
I think a lot of the teams in this tournament need to look at their selection of runs.
In the fourth quarter final, Bangladesh played Nepal, and Bangladesh made 107 for 4 off their 20 overs, and pretty disappointing, I think, for Nepal. They only made 26.
Yeah, I think I don't think anybody would have expected them to win the game, but to be bowled out in the way they did. You look at the innings, and there's one score of 8, and then the rest are all 2s, 1s, and ducks. And yeah, pretty poor performance by Nepal. I think they would have hoped to have maybe, batted out their overs, scored maybe 50 to go down like that. Even though it is against an experienced full member nation, is a very poor performance from Nepal.
In the semis, there was only one associate team left, of course, which was China, and again they had to play Pakistan. And again, Pakistan played particularly well, it seems, to win fairly comfortably. They bowled China out for 37 and chased it down with the full 12 overs remaining.
Pretty clinical performance from Pakistan. Didn't waste any time, really. And, China will be disappointed. But to get to the semi-finals of this tournament, I think, is a very good performance from China. You think they've only been an ICC member now for, 12, 13 years, and to have done this well in this tournament, I think, they can take a lot of heart from that. Even though they've been an ICC member for that long, the government's only really been interested in cricket in China for maybe about 7 or 8 years, and yeah, I think this is a good sign of progress for China.
Yeah, and they weren't completely out of it in the bronze medal game either. They had to play Sri Lanka, who lost to Bangladesh, and then subsequently Bangladesh lost to Pakistan in the finals. But China was kept to 65-6, which is probably fewer than you'd hope for them that they will get in this tournament, although the scores by the end were actually getting quite low, and perhaps the pitches were starting to wear already. But they managed to force Sri Lanka to take a full 17 overs, and they took 5 wickets in that match. So they weren't completely out of it.
No, I think they performed with a lot of credit in that bronze medal match. And, you know, they'll be disappointed not to go home with a medal, but you're fourth place in this tournament. And I think nobody would have expected them to finish ahead of Thailand or Japan, I think, is a very quality performance from them.
Moving on to the men's tournament then, same format, slightly different teams in each group. The Group A group here was South Korea, Malaysia and China. We expected Malaysia to dominate this group. Obviously, they're a much more experienced team and then playing at a much higher level of cricket than both South Korea, who, as we know, is a team of converted baseballers for the most part and basically making their international debut. And China, who the men's team, unlike the women, have struggled a bit. We did see Malaysia win these games fairly comfortably. South Korea actually, I think, did quite well in the first game. All things considered, they scored 71 for 8 off their 20 overs, made Malaysia bat out a full 12 overs to chase it down.
So pretty, you know, for a team that's for the most part only been playing for a year, to bat out 20 overs against a side as experienced as Malaysia is pretty good going, although nobody really was able to get a big score. And then Malaysia, pretty dominant in reply, then scored their runs in just under 12 overs. I think Malaysia South Korea, as we eventually went on to see, took a lot of heart from that performance. And it's a very interesting. There's a video on YouTube of the match. The entire match is on YouTube. If you look for it, and you see the South Korean batsmen, you can tell just from their batting stances who are the converted baseball players. You know, they have a backlift that makes Brian Lara's backlift look small. At least one of them actually just bats with a baseball-style batting stance, which is very strange to see in cricket. But they hit the ball straight, which is what you'd expect from a converted baseball player, I suppose.
Yeah, they weren't without some style, though, in some of the batting. I think there's a couple of late cuts that look particularly nice, and there was a couple of balls the Malaysian bowlers pitched short too, which is not something you want to be doing to a baseball because they absolutely smashed them. So you could see the potential to be good players. I think baseball is probably wrecking some of their techniques a little bit in that it's making them play across the line more so than it should, and they might probably have benefited. I think at least one player was said to have switched hands, and I think that's the sort of thing that baseballers should consider if they were going to take up the game, just because it allows you to use your top hand with your with your stronger hand.
Yeah, sure. As we said when we previewed, so it's a very interesting experiment, and I think it's succeeded in some ways and not succeeded in others. And yeah, I think other countries who are developing cricket, countries that have a baseball background, maybe sort of looking at this and being, well, maybe we can look at doing something similar.
Moving on with the matches, China, we thought would struggle, and they did against Malaysia. They made only 56-7 off their 20 overs, and Malaysia chased it down in 9 overs, so it's a fairly comprehensive victory.
Yeah, very, very, very comprehensive. Farooq Hakim took 4-14 in the Chinese innings. I think Malaysia will be disappointed not to have bowled China out. They did manage to bat out their 20 overs, but to score the runs that quickly on what was becoming a pretty tired pitch was pretty good going from Malaysia.
And the third group match here, which we're obviously particularly interested in, was South Korea versus China, and it was unfortunately reduced by rain to 10 overs. But I guess in some sense fortunate that we did get some play because of what happened in the other match on that day. The South Koreans looked like they were going to score over 100 in the 10 overs. They came into the last over, I think, in the high 80s, but one of the Chinese bowlers took 4 wickets in 4 balls across his last 2 overs to keep them to 88 for 5.
Yeah, and from as far as I can tell, that's only the second time that's happened in at any level of international cricket. But Zhong Wei, yeah, was a bowler who did it. So, see, I think that puts him in a club, I think, with Lasith Malinga, which is a pretty nice a club to be in. I think the South Korean batsman did throw the wickets away at time. There was 2 stumpings where the batters came right down the pitch, and you'd think if everybody was able to keep the feet behind the line, then it would be baseball players, because of course in baseball you're not allowed to leave the batter's box when you're playing a shot. So, but obviously that's maybe a bad habit they've picked up from playing cricket. Dysuk Sung scored 33 from just 16 balls, some pretty big hits that he managed to pull off. And but then when bowling, South Korea bowled pretty well. They were very lively in the field by all accounts. They managed to get three run outs and restrict China to 82 for 7. You know, China got very close, but it was only a 6-run defeat. But in truth, I don't think they were ever going to win the game.
No, they're certainly always behind where they need to be. And I think a lot of the run outs came from a little bit of panic that they were unable to get through the field and score the runs as quickly as they needed to. And credit to South Korea for getting what I guess is a fairly significant win for them.
Yeah, they'll be very pleased to have picked up a win. It's only their second ever win in international cricket. They picked up one in an East Asia Pacific tournament about 3 years ago, and this is only the second one. And your China are much more experienced. They've been playing cricket a long time. A lot of these players have been in the Chinese side since it first played about 10 years ago, and you know, most of the Korean side, as we said earlier, have been playing cricket less than a year. So, yeah, they'll be delighted with that performance.
And the other group, Group B, was, I think it's fair to say, it ended in farce. So the first match, Kuwait, who, as we know, is not the main Kuwait side, it's a team of all Arab players, were probably much weaker than we probably expected. They were bowled out for only 20 by Nepal in the first game, who was chased down in only 2.5 overs.
The highest score was in the Kuwait innings was 4, which gives you an idea of what he was. And Sompal Kami took 3 wickets for 4 runs and 4 overs and bowled 2 maidens. You know, it's not often you see 2 maidens on a 20-20 scorecard. Pretty clinical performance by Nepal. They'll be disappointed to have lost a wicket in that run chase. And remarkably, of course, it's not actually Nepal's most dominant win. They did once bowl Burma out for just 10. So this is probably one of the lowest score in a completed 2020 innings. And it's against Nepal. I think the lowest score in a completed one-day innings is against Nepal as well. So that's something for Nepal to be proud of.
The second match was the Maldives against Nepal, and Maldives did significantly better than Kuwait did, but they were still bowled out for 53, and then again Nepal chased it down pretty quickly in only 14.2 overs.
Yeah, I think Nepal have been a little disappointed with the fact that they conceded 13 wides. People might remember that in the World 2020 earlier this year, they didn't concede a single wide. They were the only team to do that, and then to concede 13 against the Maldives is pretty poor from them. But they did win the game quite convincingly, and Maldives got a little bit closer than Kuwait, but as we were about to say, that didn't really count for much.
No, it didn't, because strikes me as a terribly unfair thing that happened. What happened was the match was rained out. It was abandoned without a ball bowled. The tournament regulations stipulated that the match would be bowled as a bowl out if there was as a super over if there was sufficient time for a single over match. That didn't happen, which meant that the match was then determined by coin toss, not just by the net run rate in the group. Kuwait's net run rate was -6, I think, and Maldives was minus one, which is a seemingly better thing, but the coin toss favoured the Q8s, and they went through to the quarterfinals.
Yeah, a pretty farcical situation, really. You shouldn't be deciding matches in a group stage on a toss of a coin, and even in a knockout stage, it's not a particularly satisfactory way to decide anything. Yeah, I think why this was in the playing conditions for group matches, I just cannot understand. Maybe, and why not? Is there not an indoor facility nearby they could have used for a ball out? You want to decide matches with something that is as close to possible cricket, and if you can't do that on, you're using a one over eliminator, then you use a ball out. But tossing a coin, I think, is a pretty poor way to be eliminated from a tournament.
The quarterfinals that we had discussed in the last podcast, that one of the quarterfinals, two of the quarterfinals will go to the semi, such that there was always going to be an associate team in the final, which was good for whoever could make it. The two quarterfinal matchups, the Hong Kong played Malaysia in the first of those, and it was a pretty tight match. Malaysia made 129 for 7, but Hong Kong chased it down with only two balls remaining, but 7 wickets in hand.
Yeah, very tight, actually. Hong Kong did well to come back from a pretty poor start. They lost Irfan Ahmed in the first over, who's had a pretty terrible run in 2020 cricket this year, it has to be said. He played quite well in the qualifier last year, this year in the World 2020, and now in this tournament. He's had a pretty poor run. But Nizakat Khan scored 63 from 48 balls. Jamie Atkinson, 39. Hong Kong managed to win by 7 wickets. So Hong Kong will be pretty pleased with their performance to get through to the semi-final. Malaysia, they were very hopeful of getting through to the semi-finals and perhaps even winning a medal, and they'll be somewhat disappointed with their performance there, but they came up against a very, very talented side who, Hong Kong beat Bangladesh in a 2020 earlier this year, so it was always going to be a tough ask for Malaysia, but they did well to get as close as they did.
And the other quarterfinal on that side of the draw was Afghanistan versus Nepal, which Nepal was obviously pretty hopeful of managing to roll over it. It's not quite the full-strength Afghanistan side because they're playing in Australia at the same time, but it had most of their significant T20 players. And Nepal kept them to 119 for 9, which was a pretty chaseable total, but they fell just short, ending up on 111 for 7.
Yeah, you had Binod Bhandari with 48 and Gyanendra Mala with 30, but there wasn't really much to write home about other than those in the Nepal innings. Paris Katka was way out of sorts. He scored 1 from 13 balls. Which from your top batsman, you don't really want that to happen in a 2020 match. And Farid Ahmed took 4 for 17 as Afghanistan won by 8 runs. About the Afghanistan being slightly weaker, and obviously they flew 3 or 4 players over from Australia to take part in this tournament. Really, the ICC shouldn't have scheduled this World Cup preparation tour to coincide with these Asian Games. Obviously, this is a non-ICC sanctioned event, but the ICC are well within the rights to schedule a tour for Afghanistan at the same time, but they could have delayed. Obviously, the Afghanistan tour was split into two legs between Australia and New Zealand. The ICC could easily have just delayed the New Zealand leg by a few days and let Afghanistan send a full-strength side to this tournament. And although Afghanistan did win this match, and as we'll talk about in a minute, they won the semi-final, they should have been able to do so with a full-strength side.
Yeah, I can understand the ICC's also working within the schedules of Australia and New Zealand, and they have their pre-season, which is certainly, at least from Australia's perspective, is quite tight. But I agree that it was the sort of thing that could have been organised better, or perhaps even send Afghanistan before the Asian Games. And I'm not sure that there was a huge amount that they were doing in the months before this.
No, I don't think they were doing anything in the months before this. So, yeah, very poor from the ICC, really. It meant that offer both, you know, this tournament and the first couple of matches of the New Zealand leg of the tour, Afghanistan were below full strength, and, you know, that's sort of unfair, really, for Afghanistan.
To the other side of the draw, we weren't sure exactly what we were going to expect from these two games, but we were hopeful, I guess, that there wouldn't be annihilations. South Korea was playing Sri Lanka, the World 2020 champions, and although it's obviously not the full-strength Sri Lanka by any means, they still had Chandamal and Tiramin and a few other quality players. But I think it's fair to say South Korea actually did really well in this game. They kept Sri Lanka to 172 for 8 off their 20 overs, and they made 55, which, compared to what they might have been, isn't bad.
I think, you know, South Korea emerged from this with some credit. You know, only two of the Sri Lankan players managed to get double figures, although they were quite big scores, 54 and 83 respectively. A lot of credit must to go to Takwon Park. You know, he's been playing cricket, you know, less than a year. He's a converted baseball pitcher, and, you know, he's now a left-arm pace bowler. Took 4 for 16. You know, there's players who have been playing professionally for a decade who struggled to take 4 for 16 against the Sri Lankan lineup, and, you know, he's done it with less than a year's experience. So, you know, he can be very proud of what he did in that innings.
And the other quarterfinal, which Kuwait really shouldn't have been playing in, Bangladesh batted first and just absolutely thrashed them. It's a very strong Bangladesh side, pretty much their full strength side. They made 224 for 9, and then Kuwait made 21 off their 13 overs in response.
Yeah, you know, whether this was going to be against the Maldives or against Kuwait, Bangladesh are always going to win quite comprehensively, but you'd have to think that you know, Maldives would have done a little bit better than to be bowled out for 21. As we said, Kuwait should never have been in this match.
Moving on to the semi-finals, Afghanistan was playing Hong Kong. And it was a slightly rain-affected match. Hong Kong made 8 for 88 off the 20 overs, which I think they'll be pretty disappointed in. It's nowhere near a competitive target. And there was some rain around. It got reduced to 15 overs, but the target was only then 72, and Afghanistan scored that fairly comfortably with that. Still 8 wickets in hand with 21 balls left.
Yeah, and Mohammad Shahzad scored 41 from 28 balls. You know, when he gets going, he's hard to get out, and that proves to be the case again here.
The other semi-final was washed out, which meant that Sri Lanka went through on the coin toss. In Bangladesh.
Yeah, I think the coin used for these Asian games is running Tim Greuter's backscan close for inanimate objects of the year.
This meant that the third place playoff for the bronze medal was between Bangladesh and Hong Kong, and Bangladesh again batted fairly well. They scored 162 for 6 off their 20 overs, which I think Hong Kong would probably be a bit disappointed on, because it hasn't been a particularly high scoring in tournament to give up that many runs. And they actually batted quite well in response. They made 135, which probably would have been enough in the semi-final, but wasn't enough here though to lose by 27 runs.
Yeah, Bangladesh obviously looking for revenge after losing to Hong Kong in the World 2020 earlier this year. And, you know, they got it here. Irfan Ahmed, you know, obviously we said he's not had a good run. He did manage to score 31 from 18 balls for Hong Kong in this match. And, you know, Mark Chapman scored 38. But, you know, in the end, you know, that, your numbers, you know, 2, 3 and 4 for Hong Kong, you know, it's 0, 7 and 0. And, you know, that sort of upper order failed for Hong Kong. Had that upper order managed to hold together, and, you know, maybe they'd have been able to push Bangladesh a bit closer, but in the end, you know, they didn't really get closer. They'd bat out their overs. But, you know, Hong Kong know they can beat Bangladesh, and today they didn't. That day they didn't.
And in the final, Afghanistan versus Sri Lanka, I think it's fair to say it was a really disappointing performance by Afghanistan, because as we discussed with the quarterfinal, it's not a super strength Sri Lankan side, and although they kept them to 133, which in theory should have been chaseable, for Afghanistan to get bowled out for 65 was pretty below par.
When you think that it's only 10 more runs than South Korea made against Sri Lanka, that sort of puts it into context just how poor a performance it was from Afghanistan. You read some of the descriptions of the wickets, and it's shots playing across the line, coming down the pitch when you really don't need to, trying to slog the ball. And Afghanistan have a lot of talent. They have a lot of natural talent. They can bat really well, and we know they can bat really well. It's just that a lot of times they lack the intelligence to go with that talent, and you tend to throw the wickets away, especially when chasing low targets. When they're chasing a low target, they seem to panic and throw the game away. They bowled so well. After Sri Lanka got to 79 for one, and after the first sort of 10 overs, and to then bowl them out for 133 is a very good bowling performance. Mohammad Nabi took 4 for 18, Gulban Naib 2 for 16. Some good bowling there, but then the batting just let them down.
And further thoughts on the tournament, Andrew? Obviously, the formats could possibly do with a little bit of work. They'll be constrained by only having the one ground, but they should need to do something about the coin toss or what they're going to do in the event of rain. Preferably, this sort of thing should be played on two games. Other thoughts?
Yeah, they've got 4 years to think about that sort of thing before the next games in Indonesia. So they can look at that. In general, the tournament did seem to get better as it went along. In the men's tournament, the score seems to go up as the tournament went along. Rather than the pitch fading out towards the end of the tournament, perhaps it took a bit of time to bed in. And then, although obviously the teams playing towards the end are much more experienced teams who are used to dealing with varying conditions. The games got some sort of a crowd. There was sort of 200 or 300 people at some of the games. A lot of the locals were turning up, which is good to see. South Korea got a lot of home support, which I'm sure encouraged them. And whether there's any legacy for cricket in South Korea from these games, multi-sport games always have that legacy question. We have it from the Olympics in London from a couple of years ago, and I'm sure this will be no exception. Hopefully this ground in Incheon will stay and can be used for more cricket in South Korea, and hopefully some of these converted baseball players will stick with the game. There's some promise in some of those players, and hopefully they'll get the opportunity to live up to that promise. South Korea not scheduled to take part in the East Asia Pacific 2020 qualifier in November. I think on the strength of their performance here, you'd probably say they could challenge the likes of Samoa and the Cook Islands, if not sort of Fiji, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea. And you'd hope perhaps ICC East Asia Pacific may consider giving them an entry into that tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly there's grounds for hoping that they can build up a closer local regional rivalry as well with both China and Japan, because it is a long way to come out to the East Pacific, the Pacific nations for those types of tournaments. So, but they've got that ground now. They've also got a ground in Guangzhou and in Sanuo. So there's plenty of opportunities for local tours between those three nations. And as you say, hopefully the legacy will be there, and then hopefully the cricket will be kept in the games for Indonesia, and will also allow Indonesia, whose development's been laid, to themselves develop some sort of infrastructure.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of cricket being in multi-sports events, that countries that don't have much of a cricket infrastructure have to develop them when they're hosting cricket tournaments.
Joining us now on the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast is Owen Wibberley, the Secretary of the Korean Cricket League, and James Atkinson, who was the ground announcer at the Incheon Asian Games at the cricket tournament. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let's start with the tournament itself. Probably, James, you saw quite a lot of the games there. Obviously, some of the scorecards were pretty unbalanced. Do you think that was a fair reflection of all the teams that were there?
Well, probably the competition was divided up into like a group stage where the minnows basically played off to go into the finals. And that was when they were coming up against, you know, with the men's and the women's competition, those who have a fair bit of experience in cricket and, you know, those who come from test playing nations. So those games are probably always going to yield fairly unbalanced scorecards because you've kind of got the boys playing with the men in a sense. With regards to a lot of the games, like group stage teams playing up against each other, I think it was a bit more balanced within there. There weren't, the men's final was a bit of a one-sided at the end of the day.
And both semi-finals, unfortunately, as well, weren't they, really?
Yeah, but
throughout the coin toss.
The coin toss is very even.
I think it kind of, that kind of went the right way, though. I think that, if that's possible, I think Sri Lanka were going to win that game if it had gone the distance. But
yeah, they looked the goods on the day. The earlier toss that was in the competition in the group stage, which knocked out the Maldives, sent Kuwait through. That was a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
That could have been avoided on a lot of levels. But I think most of the scorecards were fairly well represented of where the teams are ranked.
Right. I think we had very close games between Korea and China.
Yep.
And there was a few other really good close games. But, I mean, Kuwait sent a team of ranked beginners and they had real trouble. They really did. I think generally the scorecards were pretty representative of the level, apart from Afghanistan having a blowout in the final.
That was just a bad day for them, but I think it's part and parcel of 2020 cricket too. You can still be the number one side in the world and lose to number six.
Yeah. And Hong Kong didn't bowl particularly well in their semi-final, unfortunately, as well.
So. Yeah. Didn't quite bring their A game on the day.
Mm.
Let's just focus on the final. Afghanistan's a team that, after they bowled, it kind of looked like maybe they should be able to chase that. Did they play a lot of bad shots, or where did it just go wrong?
Sri Lankan team were pretty good. I think it was about a half-strength international team, but also the Afghan team were probably about half-strength too. I heard they had quite a few players they sent across to New Zealand for competition. Maybe even the pressure of the occasion, I'm not too sure. They really just threw away the wickets, but the bowlers had the better of the batsmen all through. Yeah. Pretty much Afghan team, once the top four guys are gone, you've exposed not necessarily the tail, but you haven't really got a lot of quality below that.
So
once they were gone, it was a foregone conclusion, really.
It's interesting that Sri Lanka played the seven bowlers and four batsmen.
That was their
lineup, and so it was very evident after Sri Lanka had lost their first few wickets, Afghanistan got right into them, and we're thinking game on, and then they had seven frontline bowlers bowling at them. I guess that could have come into it.
It was definitely a bowler's pitch too, and Afghanistan were facing the last innings of the day on that pitch, having played a match earlier, so basically the fourth innings. So any demons that were in the pitch were definitely going to be exposed after everyone's had a good go on it all afternoon. There were a few balls which kept low and, you know, hit it on the stumps, you're going to get your guy out LB or bowled, or you know, stumped even better, or something like that.
On the Sri Lankan side, the Korea bowling went in their match against them was fairly impressive as well, do you think? Given that except for the two players who got going, they actually managed to keep almost all the other players in line.
Yeah, that was an interesting game to watch. Sri Lanka went out there treating it as their first go on that ground and on that pitch. Because of weather and facilities and so forth, they hadn't even had a chance to get in the nets. So that was basically their net session. I don't think the Sri Lankans are really taking it very seriously. And with all due respect to the South Korean bowlers, the bowling wasn't that great. It wasn't that menacing. And most of the dismissals were just the batsmen smashing it down the long on, not quite getting it off the meat of the bat, and there was a fielder camp down there.
So nine catches, but I think like Park Tae-won bowled pretty well. I mean, at the tail, I mean, he's he's no slouch. He's definitely got some pace, and
he's
getting through. And I think he's definitely got a future if we can.
Yeah, he was handy with the ball that day. Usually they'd open the pace bowling with their captain Kim Kong Shik, and he was just pretty average, to be honest, during the group stages. Mm-hmm. They changed it up and yielded immediate results, and we were all sitting back there during the group stages suggesting, like, start with your left armour, and
mm-hmm.
they did. But, yeah, the Sri Lankan batsmen weren't really on their game that day, and they were feeling out a pitch, which was a lot of uneven bounce and so forth.
Mm.
Just having a look at it before they went on to go into the semis and onto the final and so forth.
And in terms of the women's competition, was that a more even competition, do you think? Pakistan is obviously won relatively easy by the looks of it, but they're not maybe as advanced as the men's teams in that respect.
There was definitely a very large difference between the... It was a canyon of difference between the group stages and the finals. There were quite a few close matches in the finals and so forth. And then all of a sudden, Sri Lanka, Pakistan and Bangladesh came out, and it was just, oh, wow. You know, these girls are finding the boundary. Pakistan and Bangladesh were pretty close, actually. Bangladesh were very unfortunate, I should say, to come out with silver. They really went down to the last ball, and Bangladesh had it in the bag there for a while.
I was very impressed with the one women's day that I went to. I was very impressed with Thailand. I thought they played Nepal, and I'll admit I don't know too much about women's cricket, and I was expecting Nepal to be the much stronger team based on the men's team.
Mm.
And I was really impressed with Thailand. Really, like, genuine batsmen, the top order of batswomen or batters, but yeah, the top order looks.
Yeah, really they're some genuine shot players. Hong Kong too, actually.
Yeah.
They look fairly good, but yeah, once the teams from test playing nations and so forth came out, it was, oh, hang on a minute. There's 1, 2, and 3 right there.
And what about the response of the locals? How were the crowds, and did they improve as the tournament went on?
From the locals. Koreans through the door, pretty bad, to be honest. Most of the Koreans that actually came to watch were really ring-ins that brought in to fill up seats to make the stadium not look so empty for the TV cameras like they do in the Olympics and so forth. Numbers did tick up crowd-wise as it went on, because there are a lot of expats over here, and especially like Sri Lankans and Bangladeshis and Nepali guys and so forth. But Koreans didn't really get into it, even when their own team was playing in the semi-final, which was, as far as South Korea goes in cricket in the Asian Games, was the
biggest final, I guess. Yeah.
There were very few people there, but, you know, what do you do in the afternoon on a work day during the week? It's a little difficult.
Yeah. The games themselves were incredibly badly marketed, and not just cricket. Most events' attendances were very low. And on the weekdays, Koreans work really hard, and they just, you know, there were some school children, and there were some grandmothers and grandfathers and whatnot, but, you know, people are working, and it's people are not going to give up their work day to come to the cricket, which they might do in other countries, I'm not sure, but in Korea that's just not going to happen. At the weekends it was okay, but just at the weekdays.
It could have been a whole different story had they put up lights and so forth for the stadium, because on a work day you will get Koreans go out to baseball matches and so forth, but
yeah.
That's talking about quite a lot of money for a sport which is not quite nearly established here.
Yeah.
And the local media coverage, did it get in any of the games coverage, even as a kind of novelty piece?
I heard that we made a couple of spots on TV mentions.
Yeah, there was news. They were on the news, and lots of blogs, and like online blogs in Korea are quite a big thing. There were lots of blogs about the cricket, and definitely got on the news a couple of times. The women's first game was shown as a rerun the next day.
Right.
But I didn't hear of any other games being shown after that, unfortunately.
I think probably we might have got almost as much coverage outside of Korea as we did inside. I heard, like, Al Jazeera were out there a lot.
Yeah.
I heard we popped up on BBC.
And CNN. Yeah.
CNN as well.
Yeah.
Which,
fairly significant, I think. But
yeah, within the local media coverage, it's probably handled more as novelty coverage, and especially when things came up like deciding the outcome of a rain-affected match through a coin toss. Unfortunately, that made the blogs as well, because they were comparing it to sports. Like, well, tennis doesn't do that.
Yeah.
What, oh, what's this game, cricket, which decides an Asian Games?
Neither does cricket.
Yeah, well, if you've got life, it doesn't usually.
And in terms of the having cricket in the Asian Games, was there any kind of comment on that for the future? As obviously, it was had to be kind of argued for to get it in Incheon in the first place. Is it likely to continue?
Yeah, it sounds like the Asian Cricket Council are fairly keen on it, and the Asian Olympic Council also. I think they need to rejig a few things.
Yeah.
The way they have the schedule packed in, you've got the opening ceremony, then matches start the next day, right up through till the day before the closing ceremony, which they hold as a reserve day for the men's final. So.
Yeah.
When in a sport like this, when rain does affect it, there's no wiggle room
yeah.
at all. And then you have things come down like coin tosses to decide matches. So I think if they turn around and just use some of the ICC rulings to decide the outcomes of matches like that, I think it'll probably give it a bit more weight too. I mean, when people see that or read about it, say, on Cricket Info, and, oh, okay, what's happening here? Oh, match decided by a coin toss. What the hell? You know? It sounds like Mickey Mouse cricket, but...
Well, yeah, they need two stadiums, really, I think, to really have an effect. You can't have two, kind of a men's and women's tournament in one stadium in the space of 2 weeks. It's just, you can, obviously, we've proved that, but it's just too much. So,
yeah, it was a pretty hectic schedule. Yeah, two stadiums.
I'm not too sure what the situation is in Jakarta for the next games. I'm not sure how big cricket is down in Indonesia these days, but hopefully they can have a couple of facilities down there. We shall see.
Yeah, it could be interesting.
I was kind of following the games for a long time, maybe a couple of years, and it just wasn't sure where the stadium was going to be until about 3 months ago. It just seemed to appear out of nowhere. I'm not sure if that was always the way it was being organised or what. But
the location was, I think, confirmed last year. And
pretty new.
Yeah. And then they really started construction in April. And we're just like, you can't just lay a pitch and expect it to be ready.
But they did.
It was a pitch.
The pitch was 2 inches above the outfield.
Yeah, the outfield was incredibly slow. The pitch was incredibly low.
And it was overused, obviously, as well. How many? Yeah. There's like four pitches on the square?
Seven.
Oh, that's a fair few.
Yeah, so it did. All the warm-up games were with players from the league, and they played against the national team in a bunch of fixtures. And in those games, it was really low. And we were just like, you can't play international cricket on this. And amazingly, it was a lot better in the games. There were ones that kept low, but it was a lot better. So with time, I think it could develop into a reasonable pitch. Still be slow and low, but...
Yeah, the pitch is still like sitting an inch or two above the rest of the outfield. It needs a lot of water to go in there and for it to fully settle down and drop. That's obvious.
Turning to cricket in Korea, what is the current status of cricket in Korea? You kind of indicate that it's not well known. How many players are there and how many grounds?
Well, the Incheon Stadium is the first purpose built turf wicket, grass outfield. Normally, grass is a very, very hard thing to come by as a playing surface in Korea. So mostly we play on the dirt outfields with a running track around it, and then we have the plastic flicks pitch that we roll out in the middle. And we've got three flicks pitches. So we play at a variety of universities around the Seoul metro area. Unfortunately, nowhere in Seoul. Seoul's too many soccer teams wanting to play. There's tape ball and tennis ball cricket all over the country, but with the price of these pitches, we really only have two regular locations we can use. And hopefully we will have the stadium in the future. And certainly the training facility that they built, which I haven't seen yet. But this is all, yeah, we're all not so certain about how all this stuff's going to go at the moment. It's all up in the air.
Mm. All up in the Korean Cricket League. How many teams have we got now? Is it 13?
13 teams playing hardball cricket. And they're from teams all over the world. So,
two of those are Korean teams, too. One being the national team who's in the top division, and there's also a Korean university. Mm-hmm. So, like, two entire teams in the main league consisting entirely of Koreans.
Uh-huh. But that's about it, unfortunately. So we're trying to spread it, but it is difficult. Yeah.
And when you say spreading it, that's the junior development programs, or is it?
There's junior development that goes on, and hopefully the hope was that these games would spread awareness, and then from that they'll be able to spread it into more universities, more elementary schools and stuff like this. But it's difficult. We're not privy to really this information about the development. We're not asked, we better ask for the players in the league's help in any way. So we're all willing to help, but we haven't been asked yet. So we're going to start taking it into our own hands in the next year or so, really. But hopefully with the exposure that the games have brought, then we can start at least taking it to more schools and setting up more junior programs. That's the dream, as it were. Yeah.
I'd like to ask about you have obviously the Korean Cricket League with it. It seems to have a relatively loose association with the association, which is obviously the ICC members and who put together the national team. Is that a fair summary?
Oh, they used to be. It used to be very intrinsically involved. But I would say about 3 years ago, the KCA themselves decided to focus purely on the national team. So we are a KCA affiliated league, but that's about where it stops. You know, the national team play in our league, and everything else is run. I mean, I'm the secretary of the league. Two friends of mine, one who's a manager of the league. We're not official KCA officials. We're volunteers. There's one other guy who is a director of the KCA. He works with the league, but we're all volunteers mostly. So yeah, that's the way it is.
From what you know of this process of putting together the national side, how did this come about in the first place? Because it's obviously quite an interesting experiment to take on baseball players and convert them.
It was, yeah. Well, basically, I'm not too certain of the advertising process, but they put adverts out, and they just looked for natural athletes. They didn't say we want baseball players. They got guys and they were like, right, how high can you jump? How far can you throw a ball? Stuff like that. And they picked players based on natural ability. There's two or three, maybe four. The wicketkeeper, he played in Samoa in 2011. I think he's the sole surviving member of that team. And there's a couple of guys who played cricket in Oz, like they went to school in Oz and stuff.
Yeah, one of the openers, I think he lived in Oz until he was about 15 or something like that.
Yeah, the opener, Daniel Ilhan. So he speaks with a strong Aussie accent. But all the others, basically, they would never really play cricket. Most of them baseball players, not gone at all of them. They just picked natural athletes and just taught them from scratch. It's amazing. I mean, like, it is really amazing to see how far they've come. As a comparison, my team, James and I would play on the same team. We're very much a social, I'll say village. We're like a village team, basically. And we played their team, the national team, in the first game of last year's tournament in 2013. And we got them all out for 50, and we chased it down in 9 or 10 overs. And then the start of this season, we played them again, and they did the same to us. So just, I guess, being full-time professionals, you'd expect improvement, but they've done that, and then from there, I mean, destroying a village team is one thing, but then going and taking 8 wickets against Sri Lanka and is an amazing achievement, I think. They've done fantastically well. But there's too many flat bats and too many wide stances, like baseball stances out there. They need to get some work on their footwork and play with a bit straighter bats, I think, from looking at them.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so which of the areas do you think would are the most difficult to pick up in this type of thing? What lessons should other leagues take if they're trying a similar type of experiment?
Well, what they seem, they're really good in the field. They very rarely drop catches and stuff like that. So their fielding has been great. Their bowling, they've taken to, well, they've really, there's a variety of spinners, not international standard yet, but showing real potential. Only been playing 2 years, great. But the batting, there's got a couple at the top and then not much after that. So I mean, they've really got to focus on batting. Yeah, the batting technique is so alien.
Yeah, well, you get the top three guys out of the South Korean side, you've really exposed the tail. The rest of the team just falls delivery after delivery. Yeah. It's kind of hard to like suggest ways for them to improve.
Just time in the middle. They need to go out there and they need to be playing week in, week out, competitive cricket with experienced guys who can teach them and they need to be playing alongside experienced guys. But the Korean guys, they've played exclusively with themselves. For the last 6 months, they've had Julian Fountain as an outside coach, but before that, their coach was Korean. He's a handy player. Ihao Hwaeon, I don't know why he wasn't playing, to be honest. They need experience with experienced cricketers, I think, playing alongside them, and they can learn from them.
Doesn't have the culture either.
Right.
Like we had when we were growing up, you know, we were throwing the ball around and playing backyard cricket, and you get a feel for the game, but it'll take time to develop. Just watching China out there alongside South Korea, they probably have about 7 years, I guess, of history in their cricketing.
So, training and so forth.
Yeah, big heads up over South Korea, and technically, a lot of the guys looked good. Yeah. With that, there were one or two guys who, you know, took to this wide stance with the knees bent and the bat up behind the shoulders.
Mm.
But far fewer than South Korea, actually. I was surprised they didn't do a little better. That's the way the mop flops. But yeah, just time, like Owen said, and playing against quality, too. I think playing every second or third weekend against guys like us who were just weekend warriors and stuff.
Yeah. It's
not really going to push them to their, their limits.
They need to be having, there's a few guys who show real potential now that they need to be going over to Oz, or England, or wherever and playing club cricket and learning footwork and learning the culture and the really how to play the game, I think.
Yeah, sending them overseas would probably be a good idea.
That's something that East Asia Pacific has done for a number of nations, I think Vanuatu and PNG particularly. Is it something that you know of that is now being mooted for Korea, or it's a bit up in the air?
We've no idea at the moment. I mean, I've got contacts in England, and I know a bunch of guys who've got contacts all over who would be able to sort this out, and we've put it out there. So we'll wait and see.
I think a lot of that might be down onto individual players
who
are willing to do it as well. You know, the guys are fairly young, and so they're old enough to still get, say, a working holiday visa to Australia for a year or two.
Yeah.
Where they could go over and, you know, just go and play club cricket on weekends and train and have a job during the day and so forth. Mm. But, you know, they're going to want to do that if there's something to come back to Korea to use their new skills on.
That's it. They've given up the last 18 months of their lives, like, full-time. I know a bunch of them are going back to university, so they're not going to be full-time anymore. Just hopefully they do continue with the game.
This was something, actually, that came up when we interviewed someone from China, that players would have, in China, they have a scholarship university, and then they kind of get lost from the game when they start working. Is this also something that's a concern in Korea, particularly not just for the national team, but other Korean players?
It's been happening for 10 years or so, or close to 10 years, but there have been some good, talented Koreans who've come through the university team that we've had, full of Koreans for years. And the only player, two, that have actually stuck with it, the wicketkeeper Bang Soo-in and Lee Hwa-yeon, the manager and coach, are the only guys who are products of that system who are really, really sticking around and playing. which is a shame. They start working and then they've just got no time. Mm. Don't have time for sport once you're a salary man in Korea. that's the unfortunate way it is. So we need to start people earlier than university. I think that's the key.
Well, that's all the questions I had. It obviously, I think it's fair to say that Korea actually had a really good tournament. It was certainly better than I was expecting. I'm not sure whether you guys agree.
Yeah. I'm really proud of the guys. I thought they did great. Yeah.
I think the women's team weren't disgraced either. Watching all of their games and so forth.
They really did start 6 months ago. You know, they did fantastically well. The men,
they'd probably be more disappointed by the first match they played against, I think it was Malaysia.
Yeah.
And they were pretty nervous. There was a lot of media, a lot of expectation and so forth. And they looked shaky when they started.
Mm-hmm.
But Malaysia are a much better side.
Sure. At the start of the tournament, I was saying to the guys, it's like, you know, like, Malaysia will be very tough, but China's a game you can win. I mean, it'll be a difficult game to win, but it's a game you can win. And they won it. And, like, so... fair play to them.
It would be nice to see Korea team up with or get together with, say, a team like the Chinese team and someone else around here who's at a similar level or possibly a little better and develop maybe kind of tri-nations.
Hong Kong are willing, so hopefully...
Hong Kong are much, much better, but it'd be nice to have that standard involved.
Well, there's Japan as well. Like.
Yeah, Japan, obviously. I mean, Japan's the obvious one. Have tri-nations between Japan... China and Korea. I mean, China have got a stadium that's there and ready to use. Korea hopefully will still have a pitch. And if we can just get more teams coming and going, and that's the way forward.
Well, thank you very much for your time, guys. Fascinating.
No problem. It's been good fun.
Yep, all good. Thanks.
Switching across now, Andrew, to Africa Division 2. This was played in Benoni in South Africa. We had expected that Nigeria would move through from this tournament because they, obviously, the only World Cricket League team, and they were promising in the local newspaper before they left that they would come back with gold and qualify. But they never really got going. The opening 2 days went sort of to script. Gambia and Ghana, Zambia, and Nigeria all won their opening two matches. Nigeria, though, did look a bit rusty. They only won their first match by 10 runs and then by 28 runs. And that was to indicate that as the tournament went on that they weren't quite right.
No, I don't know whether Nigeria went in just assuming they were going to win and then were surprised at the quality of some of the other teams or what. But yeah. Nigeria were pretty poor, to be frank. You know, on the third day they lost to Ghana, and which you wouldn't have expected going into the tournament. And then, the next day they lost to the Seychelles, and a team as experienced as Nigeria really shouldn't be losing to a team like the Seychelles. So pretty poor from Nigeria, especially losing by 7 wickets, which is. Pretty terrible, really. And then, throughout that, Zambia were sort of unbeaten. They were looking like they were going to be getting promoted to Division 1. But then on the last day, Ghana came back absolutely hammered. Mozambique won by 131 runs. And then Nigeria, remarkably, after playing terribly on the first 4 days, managed to beat Zambia by 61 runs. For Ghana to get promoted, they had to thrash Mozambique, and Nigeria had to thrash Zambia, and both of those things happened. So everything went right for Ghana on that last day.
Yeah, it was a remarkably close tournament. The result of all those changes was that Ghana and Zambia ended up with 4 wins apiece. Nigeria ended up with 3, and Seychelles, who'd beaten Nigeria the previous day, they lost to Swaziland, so both of them ended up on 2 wins as well. I mean, the only poor team is Mozambique, who more or less thrashed in every game, although they had their moments as well.
Mozambique will be extremely disappointed with how they played. Swaziland were the promoted side, and you finished with 2 wins. And as you say, as Mozambique apart, I think most teams at a decent tournament, and Nigeria will be very disappointed to have only finished third, but they had a lot of influence on that final day by beating Zambia, and I'm sure they'll be pleased they managed to do that, if not win the tournament. And now Ghana will go to Division 1, and if they can finish ahead of Botswana in that tournament, then they can get into the World Cricket League. So it's obviously a very big result for Ghana.
And we believe only one team goes through as well, Andrew. And there was some rumours that it might be two going through to Division 1.
Although I think there's only five teams currently in Division 1, so it would only make sense for one to go through. So you've got a 16 tournament. And but unfortunately, as ever with ICC Africa, we're not entirely sure what's going on.
Moving on then, Andrew, to the Associate Tours of New Zealand and Australia. These are the warm matches that have been put in place by the ICC to prepare the teams for the World Cup next year. I think it's fair to say, overall for these games, that the teams are using them to get used to the conditions. They're not necessarily their full strength, and I think it's important to point that out, because I think people who don't necessarily follow Associate Cricket don't necessarily realise when the teams aren't at full strength and when they're being beaten badly because they've never played on a bouncy pitch before, and that these things take a little bit of time, and that's why they're there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You saw in one of the Ireland matches, the first Ireland match, where they got pretty comprehensively beaten by Queensland. In a normal match, John Mooney wouldn't only bowl five overs and then not bat. That's not what Ireland would normally do. They're experimenting to some degree, and they were playing against a very talented Queensland side. Usman Khawaja opened the batting, and Mooney got him out early on for only 11 runs. So, a good start for Ireland, but pretty quickly came unglued in that match, with Queensland scoring 322 for six. Ireland were missing almost all their county players. George Dockrell's the only regular county player in the Ireland side in this match, and obviously better known for his bowling, but top scored for Ireland with 32 in that innings, as they were bowled out for 92. But a poor start for Ireland, but there is, as we say, some justification for that poor performance, given that they were so below strength.
Yeah, Ireland, I guess, is only their kind of second 11 in this sense, and or at least an A side, and so they'll move across to New Zealand and hopefully they get some players, the younger players, to get a good look at them as well. And Scotland is, we may as well talk about next, is much closer to full strength, and they lost their first game to Tasmania pretty badly by 186, but they've come back since then. They beat them by 10 runs, fairly strong Tasmanian side, preparing themselves for their first class season. Now moving across to New Zealand.
After that first Tasmania match, I think people were ready to write off Scotland as no hope, as that they were incapable of winning. And then Scotland in that second match, they lost Kyle Kurtzer and Callum McLeod, probably their two best batsmen, certainly the most experienced, and then Kyle Kurtzer and Callum McLeod, who's capable of putting on big scores. They were both gone within the first seven overs. And then Scotland came back to score 244. Matt Cross scored 64 from just 50 balls against a talented Tasmanian bowling attack. Tim van der Gooten, the Dutch international, was playing for them in this game. And then Tasmania were bowled out for 234. A very decent bowling performance from Scotland. Leask and Evans both took three wickets. And as you say, against a talented Tasmanian side, a very good performance from Scotland there.
Looking at the other two sides, the UAE, we mentioned last time that they'd lost to West Australia in their first two matches by 38 runs and by 9 wickets. It was a fairly big loss. They then moved up to the Northern Territory, who they defeated the Northern Territory side by 4 wickets. That's obviously not a first-class side. And then Papua New Guinea, who for strange ICC only reasons wasn't considered a one-day international, and therefore wasn't Papua New Guinea's ODI statistical debut, but UAE won anyway by 7 wickets with 10 balls remaining.
Papua New Guinea, you know, scored 267 for 7 from their 50 yards, so very good performance for them. You know, Tony Ura top scored with 73. But they were unable to really take any wickets. You started with a partnership of 50, then there was a partnership of 71, and then they were 124 for 3, and then Swapnil Patil and Saqib Ali scored 72 and 73, not out, to win the game by 7 wickets. A pretty comprehensive win for the UAE. And after that, those two games in Western Australia, they've been glad to have got off the mark with those two wins at the start of the Northern Territory leg of the tour.
Yeah, and they finished in Darwin with a loss to South Australia by 103 runs, and then another loss by only 2 wickets. That's quite a lot remaining. The batting for the UAE hasn't quite clicked on any of the matches so far. The indications seem to be that they're just not used to the bounce of the pitches.
I think that's a fair assessment. The bowling as well let perhaps South Australia get away with a couple of things. You know, South Australia in that second game were, they were 111 for 5, 131 for 6, 153 for 7, 153 for 8. You'd expect most teams to win from that position. They sort of let Johan Botha score 65, and sort of get South Australia back into the game, really. And UAE probably should have won that last game. And of all the sides so far, UAE have perhaps emerged with the most credit from these tours.
Afghanistan also played West Australian 11. It wasn't a strong side. And again, did pretty badly in the first game that they played. They bowled out for 114, and West Australia chased that quickly. But again, the second match, again, West Australia had scored 235 and Afghanistan 142. So all the games in West Australia have shown up the sides so far, particularly the two Asian sides, in terms of getting used to the conditions.
Yeah, Perth probably has conditions quite unique to Australia, as various full member touring sides have found over the years, and expecting the UAE and Afghanistan to go to Western Australia and do well, it was probably expecting a little bit too much. Pretty poor from Afghanistan. Afghanistan were at full strength for this Australian leg of the tour. But then, they went to Canberra and played the Australian Capital Territory or the New South Wales second 11, depending on which website you read. Won the first match by 3 wickets. And then won the second by 5 wickets. Obviously, Australian Capital Territory, not a first-class side, similar to Northern Territory, but Afghanistan did well to beat them in those two games.
Yeah, they followed again. They went to New Zealand with a much weaker side and lost again quite comprehensively, so 177 runs. And they were continuing in New Zealand for a little while. I'm not sure if they've been rejoined by the Asian Games squad members for the last couple of games, but they'll take a bit, I think, out of at least beating the New South Wales side. And I guess, as much as anything, we said already that they'll take a lot out of playing on pitches and on Australian grounds, even early in the summer, that obviously carry a lot more bounce and pace than they would get anywhere that they normally play.
And I think you have to hope that All of these teams will have some more cricket to play before the World Cup. I know there's talk about an ODI series currently between Afghanistan and the UAE. We hope that goes ahead. Ireland and Scotland don't seem to have anything scheduled at the moment, although there's rumours that Ireland will be playing in the West Indies again early next year. Hopefully that will happen. Because these teams need all the preparation they can get. Just going back for a moment to the UAE tour, you look at the venues they're playing in. They played in Perth and then they played in Darwin. In the actual World Cup, they'll play one match in Perth, one match in Brisbane, and 4 matches in New Zealand. So in terms of preparing them for the conditions they face, Darwin is you know, very different from the rest of Australia in terms of climate and conditions, and whether this is actually adequately prepared the UEE in terms of getting them used to the conditions, I think is quite questionable.
Yeah, I guess it's also, it comes down to the timing. The New Zealand season's just starting, and it might have been considered difficult to get a lot of cricket in at this time of year, but I mean, they're playing other games there, so you would think that they could have sent the UAE across for some of that.
The second match between Auckland and Afghanistan has been rained off today as we're recording this, so obviously the weather isn't particularly good in New Zealand at this time of year. But yeah, very disappointed that the UAE couldn't play any cricket in New Zealand.
Moving on to news then, Andrew. Obviously, the really big news that's come out in the last couple of weeks since we last recorded is that World Cricket League Division 3 has been moved from Uganda to Malaysia. This is ostensibly because of the safety issues and possible terrorist threat. I think also that a number of teams were very reluctant to go there. The USA, obviously, but Bermuda as well.
Yeah, a couple of Bermuda players had said they weren't going to go. A lot of US players had said they weren't going to go. Nepal weren't too pleased about it, from what I'd heard as well. And to some extent, it's Malaysia again. Malaysia haven't played a World Cricket League tournament outside of Malaysia and Singapore. As we've said on previous episodes, part of the aim of the World Cricket League was to give teams experience of different conditions around the world, and Malaysia aren't getting that out of the World Cricket League. They're playing every tournament either at home or in Singapore, where they play every year anyway. Nepal is there. Nepal has taking part in the tournament. Nepal gets good crowds. The games get televised when these tournaments are in Nepal. Play it in Nepal. Also in Malaysia, I've played a lot in Nepal in recent years, but Malaysia, to be fair, has some absolutely superb facilities. It's certainly the best facilities of the teams playing in this tournament, except maybe the ground in Florida for the USA, or the USA aren't going to be allowed to host any tournaments at the moment. But it's Malaysia again, and let's have a change for Malaysia.
Yeah, look, on the USA, it's enduring embarrassment that they can't actually host a tournament like this, because they are the only team of the six teams who can't host, and they really should be able to, because they're the biggest associate in terms of playing numbers, and there's really no reason why they can't organise themselves, apart from the fact that USAGA's useless.
Yeah, it seems that every week we have to talk about how embarrassing USAGA are, which is disappointing. USAGA should have been able to step into horses, Tony. You can play cricket in Florida at the end of October and early November. I think the USA have hosted an America's tournament in October before, so they could have hosted this tournament had their board been able to get their act together, but unfortunately they've not. But moving back to Malaysia, you have to worry when Malaysia finally do play outside of Malaysia and Singapore and outside of Asia. Full stop. They've not played outside of Asia since the 2001 ICC Trophy. That's a long time. That's an entire generation of players who have never played an international match outside of Asia, and they could be in for it if they get through this Division 3, which you always expect the host to do well, and get to Division 2 where you're playing in Namibia on some very high quality grounds. And Malaysia could be in for a bit of a rude awakening. They're going to find themselves coming up against conditions that they're just not used to, and in terms of that aim of the World Cricket League to give teams experience of different conditions around the world, Malaysia have been failed by the ICC.
Other news coming out of some of the Asian sides, Oman, who recently got their associate status, is putting the money into ground improvements, amongst other things, hosting a women's tournament, so good to see that they're stepping up the development program in line with the new status.
Although it was notable that like the UAE, Oman didn't send a team to the Asian Games. So development in that terms, just forgetting the native population just in the game is failing, but the actual facilities in Oman, they're improving. I think this will be their, I think their third ground with a turf wicket. Obviously, it's in, got floodlights as well, so you'll be looking at perhaps moving to host ODIs, neutral site ODIs, for Pakistan's home games, if Pakistan wants to have a break from the UAE. And you can also host teams like Afghanistan. Afghanistan can play there as well as playing in the UAE. So, and having three, if you've got Doha now, have three grounds of turf wickets, that brings them into potentially hosting World Cricket League tournaments in the future. So, yeah, this is very good development for Omani cricket.
And speaking of development, Afghanistan have managed to find a €700,000 from the German government to help construct a cricket stadium in the Eastern Coast province as well. So this is, I think, the second stadium that's been funded through aid development of European nations. Good that they're getting behind cricket as a unifying force in Afghanistan and helping the local cricket.
There's aid money coming from India and Sri Lanka as well to build stadiums. Afghanistan have got themselves into a very good position as well. They don't need to spend their own money on developing facilities. Other countries are willing to get behind them and help them out. So it's good for Afghanistan, that.
And finally, a preview of a tournament. I don't have a huge amount of information about this tournament, but Peru and Brazil will be heading to Colombia for a tournament in Bogota that's on this weekend as we're recording now. So Colombia's not played a lot of cricket recently, so it's good to see them back in the fold, and they're hoping to use that to then move into the South American Championships later.
There's been a bit of media coverage of this tournament as well. There's a native Colombian playing for Colombia in the tournament. There's a very good interview with him in the Independent, the UK newspaper. If you can look for it on their website, he describes cricket as being like warfare and how the game sort of instantly attracted him. And it's a fascinating tale of how your cricket can, if you let it, attract the locals in these countries, in these developing countries. And hopefully Colombia can do well. Whether they can, your move towards joining the ICC from this is another question entirely. I think, I'm not sure the ICC is currently open to new members. But you can help with developing their facilities. They have a ground there with these artificial pitches, but they do have a cricket ground there, which looks from the photos of it to be quite a decent ground with a well-kept up outfield. So hopefully this is the start of something for Colombia, and they can play more of these tournaments and, as you say, get into the South American Championships in the future.
And that's all we have this week. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Russ, as always.